right, everyone. It's Monday, November 25th. I have to look. I know it's the attitude. I know you know I'm based in Concord, but the weather today is it almost caresses your face. It's this beautiful, almost fall day. It is gorgeous out there. And I was just outside putting out some Christmas decorations, and I was just sitting there going, oh, my God, this is what perfection is. Today is a lovely, lovely day. It was kind of a bizarre weekend and a crazy last week, but today is a lovely day. Anyway, on The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Ken, you have an opening comment for today, given what's been going on.
And yes, then we will bring in your opening statement before this congressional committee.
Yeah, that's right. There. We have a great Rethink the Week. All right.
Hold on.
What are you going to say? I want to make sure I grab you. What did you say? He can't recall what? All right, keep going.
I want to tell you about two things I did over the weekend.
Okay.
But first, I want to say that last week, the end of last week, was November 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1963, November 22nd, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And he had two speeches with him that he was going to deliver on that day, but which he never got to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
But it is worth noting some of the things he said.
Mm-hmm. Or wanted to say.
That he had written to say in 1963, which was a long, long time ago. There will always be dissident voices heard in the land, expressing opposition without alternatives, finding fault but never favor, perceiving gloom on every side, and seeking influence without responsibility. Those voices are inevitable. It's incredible. It sounds like he was writing yesterday, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
But today, other voices are heard in the land, voices preaching doctrines wholly unrelated to reality, wholly unsuited to the 60s or to the 21st century.
Right.
Doctrines which apparently assume that words will suffice, that vituperation is as good as victory, and that peace is a sign of weakness. It's astounding that some of these things about uniting the country and people off on false narratives and thinking that paying lip service to something rather than really improving the lot of the American people and the world in general, it could be today. It absolutely
what's that
could
great
be
expression? History doesn't repeat, but it
rhymes.
It rhymes.
Yeah,
exactly.
It almost sounds like it's repeating here.
Yeah.
But I wanted to tell you about two things that I did this weekend.
Okay.
And it has to do with the presidential race. I went to see two candidates in person, saw Cory Booker at a house party.
I heard it was huge turnout. Is that true?
It was humongous.
He was blown away by the turnout is what I heard. Yeah.
Yeah. And the people were blown away by his speech. It was really pretty remarkable.
As
you and I have said many times, Arnie, when he speaks, he just sounds so uplifting. I mean, it's very Kennedy-esque, actually.
Yes, he definitely is that.
He has that JFK way of just making people want to follow him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was his usual recounting some of the history of racial equality in America and his living in a very, very poor neighborhood. You know, he lives in a public housing project in downtown Newark. And his life and his growing up, you know, he was the beneficiary of parents. His parents got a house for him and the family in a white neighborhood.
Yeah.
And when the parents originally showed up, they were told, sorry, the house has already been spoken for.
Unavailable.
And then they sent testers in there
like housing
discrimination lawyers used to do in the day. And the white testers got offered the house. And so Corey's parents showed up at the closing with their lawyer.
Would you have loved to have been there with a camera? Oh, my God. This is when having a cell phone back then would have been really an advantage.
And I don't know if Corey is expanding on the story, but he says that the lawyer for the sellers who thought he was selling to a white guy, the lawyer punched Corey's lawyer in the face.
I think that's actually true. I've heard him tell that story. He couldn't do that without knowing that a million fact checkers would be there. So I'm sure there are pictures of the black eye.
It's unbelievable. So, you know, he's got a history of knowing that standing up for people that are not yourself and not your tribe is a good thing.
Right.
And it's only because of that he was able to get into a good college, great college, and good law school. And
zip codes matter when it comes to quality education.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But he was just so inspiring, Arnie. And then the second person that I heard was Elizabeth Warren.
Mm-hmm.
And she was fantastic. It was not very different from her usual stump speech, which I've heard a number of times, but she gave it better than I've ever heard before.
And where was she this
incredibly
time?
Coherent. This was at a middle school in
Manchester.
Manchester?
Manchester, yeah, okay. at a middle school. And
you heard the voice of Ron Abramson, yes, who has endorsed Elizabeth Warren, by the way. But we will bring him in a second.
She was wonderful, and the crowd was wild, as often is the case with her, because, as you said, Arnie, she speaks to real people.
Yeah.
This is your concern, like your job is leaving the country
and
your health insurance is gone and your family has various needs that are not being addressed and the Wall Street bankers are making out like bandits. And she gets terrific applause for that. But you know what else that I picked up on that I think is really a wonderful sign? And that is that she referred to racial profiling. And another racial issue, I guess the voter suppression in Georgia and other places against African Americans. And for each of those statements about African American, audience was all white. Everybody just stood up and cheered. She got the loudest ovation for the two topics that relate to people
really
unlike all of the audience.
The racial profiling, in a way, is code for Mayor Bloomberg and stop and frisk. And voter suppression is a kiss to Stacey Abrams, who now is being looked at as a possible VP for at least virtually every candidate running. So it's so interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, if you understand the politics of all this, you also understand the messaging that's going on with people like Elizabeth
But
Warren.
I'm not talking about Elizabeth's messaging, which I understand you're addressing. But I'm talking about
the
fact that all these white people were the most gung-ho for this discussion about what's wrong racially in America and how African-American people are treated badly. And that, to me, says a lot. It's sort of the flip side of Corey's helping other people. The last thing I want to say is that I went up to Corey afterwards and I said to him, I love your speech, and I've always loved the way you raise our ideals. I think that you and Elizabeth Warren should run on a ticket together. Uh-huh.
And what did he say?
And he brightened up. He was really interested. Oh, that's a good idea.
What would be really –
because it had never occurred to him before.
No. But what would be interesting is Corey in the lead and Elizabeth is VP. And let me just tell you what – I know you want the reverse. I know. I capisce. But there's a reason for this in a lot of ways. But I want to go back to one more thing about Elizabeth Warren.
Okay.
I've always said this, and I think – I'm waiting for the ad to say this. It's not that Elizabeth Warren has a plan for that. Mm-hmm. It's that Elizabeth Warren has a plan for me.
Right.
Every time I hear Elizabeth Warren, there is a piece of me that fits into those plans and I go, it would change my life. It would improve my life. This is good for my children. This is good for my community. And I want people to know it isn't a plan for that. It is a plan for me. Personalize it, because that's really how people think. All right, we got to go.
Exactly.
Those are
ordinary people, not
ordinary
Wall Street people, which is what
a lot
of the centrists.
All right, we have a Rethink the Week. We're going to grab – Dean Spiliotis is showing up shortly. He always comes in a few minutes late. Ron Abramson is an immigration lawyer, now with Shaheen and Gordon. He is here. And then joining us by phone is going to be Bill Curry. Who's our phone? Stephen Pimpare. God, I'm losing it. But before I do that, I've told everyone I'm going to begin every day until Thanksgiving reading out loud the words of Lieutenant Colonel Vidman. I think these are powerful words. I think these words cannot be repeated enough. They were a civics lesson. He says the following: the uniform I wear today is that of the United States Army. The members of our all-volunteer force are made up of a patchwork of people from all ethnicities, regions, socioeconomic backgrounds who come together under a common oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. We do not serve any political party. We serve the nation. I'm humbled to come before you today as one of many who serve in the most distinguished and able military in the world. The Army is the only profession I have ever known. As a young man, I decided I want to spend my life serving this nation. It gave my family refuge from authoritarian repression. For the last 20 years, it has been an honor to represent and protect this country. Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the U.S. as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life, the only home he has ever known, to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer life. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself. and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. In fact, my little brother sits behind me today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, and frankly, it is the story of being American. I also recognize that my simple act of appearing here today, just like the courage of my colleagues who have also truthfully testified before this committee, would not be tolerated in many places around the world. In Russia, my act of expressing concern to the chain of command in an official and private channel would have severe personal and professional repercussions. Ah, but offering public testimony involving the president would surely cost me my life. I am grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant where we can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Now, this is the most amazing part. Dad, I am sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. It is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union, come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. I just want everyone to know that right after he said that, the New York Times released a story that said that the military was so worried about his safety that they were thinking of moving him and his family to a military base. He must be fine. He must be fine. That's all I have to say. All right. Joining us right now by phone is Stephen Pimpare. Stephen Pimpare is a CARSI fellow and a professor at UNH in Manchester. Welcome to the program, Stephen. How are you?
Hi, Arnie.
We have in studio Dean Spiliotis. He's a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. You hear him regularly on Friday on New Hampshire Public Radio for their sort of equivalent of Rethink the Week. Welcome back to the program, Dean.
Hi, Arnie.
And joining us in studio, as I mentioned before, is Ron Abramson, a Elizabeth Warren supporter, a lawyer, and an immigration lawyer now with Shaheen and Gordon. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Arnie.
I don't know where to begin. I've been reading every single day Vindman's testimony. I mean, when he was giving it, I was just astounded. I was just in front of the TV, and the tears were pouring down my cheeks. And I posted on Facebook, and I posted with your art the list of topics that the standout of the last 2 weeks have really been these remarkable group of women. I'm going to amend that. I don't know who wasn't a standout, to be honest with you. And Stephen, I need to tell you that as I was listening to them, it's so funny. I keep going back to when I was 17. What did I want to be when I grow up? And when I was 17, I thought I wanted to be a minister. And the reason I wanted to be a minister was that we had a phenomenal, phenomenal, courageous, wonderful, outspoken guy who really sort of set me on fire. And I thought, I want to be like him. And then I grew up, and then I started hearing a bunch of union organizers. And I'm thinking, wow, I should have done that. I want to be a union organizer. And then over the last 2 weeks, I wanted to be working for the State Department. I wanted to be them. So, Stephen, as you look back at the last 2 weeks, they say that it didn't move the American people, that maybe the Republican line is that it's boring. You know, that's always the way they sort of frame everything. But what about the last 2 weeks? Is there a way that we can learn not only from the lessons that were taught in the last 2 weeks, but figure out a way to take those lessons and teach the American people? Because nobody spent hundreds of hours listening or wanted to listen to the commentary, but yet there were some really powerful moments that I think are important for us to understand what are the consequences of 2020 and what it is that we ultimately need to value if we're going to value our democratic institutions. Do you think there is a way for us to translate any of that into a messaging for the American people?
I do. This is an extraordinarily difficult moment to be teaching American politics, as I'm sure Dean can attest, and particularly challenging because I want to give students sort of a clear-eyed, critical perspective of what's going on and, to my mind, sort of the institutional failures that we are witnessing. But I don't want their response to that to be to curl up in a corner and sob and feel that it is hopeless. And I found myself, over the course of last week in particular, in having conversations with students talking about, this is going to sound super corny, what I started calling sort of the nobility of American bureaucracy, right? And sort of pointing out to them that the federal government, not to mention your state and local governments, are filled with people just like the ones we saw giving testimony over the course of the last 2 weeks. Super smart, dedicated, committed professionals who understand their obligation to the nation above all, and mean that in this really profound way. And I think that is one of the ways in which we can communicate to people that not all of your government is failing you, and it is in fact still functioning in these profoundly important ways, but we need to make sure that it can continue to do so.
So, Dean, speaking of the other professor sitting here in the crowd, and you teach civics and you're a presidential scholar, listening to what Stephen said, have you been talking about this with your students at all? Were they engaged at all? Or is this almost – I was listening to an article about UNH in Durham that, you know, a lot of Republican – young Republican students are afraid of actually opening their mouth or having a conversation because they feel like they're going to be shunned. So how do you thread the needle in a governing, professional way so that you can teach your students at the same time making sure that it doesn't appear like you're taking sides, sure, but yet civics is being taught?
Yeah, and I mean, you always have to be sensitive about that. That just goes with the territory. You know, the students – interest among the students, it varies. There are some students who are following it very closely. Others maybe a little bit less so. You know, I typically take the approach of focusing on the functioning of institutions. So there's a long tradition in political science of doing research on differences between the presidency and the executive branch. Right. The president controls the executive branch, but he is not literally the executive branch. And it is not unusual for presidents to come into office, have particular political goals that they want to pursue, certain preferences that are out of line with the permanent bureaucracy, so to speak. And they have two options. They can either try to slowly turn the ship of state around and try to line it up with their preferences. Ronald Reagan did this very effectively with a clearance. He put in a bureaucratic clearance in the executive office of the president to kind of control what kinds of policy was being implemented. There are lots of ways in which you can bring the bureaucracy in line with your preferences. The alternative is to basically go around it or ignore it. That's why we traditionally see, and it's, you know, Trump is perhaps an extreme example of this in terms of pressing a set of preferences that are different from what the permanent bureaucracy would recommend. But all presidents at some level, you look over time, they end up falling back and relying on their key political advisors around them in the White House, precisely because
Trump has
it's
not
challenging. What?
Trump
well,
has not.
He's got a couple. Well, Giuliani is an example.
Oh, okay.
A couple of these other guys.
But he's not in the government.
Well, he's
right.
But he's an extreme
advisor.
Example of a president pursuing political goals in conflict with what the bureaucratic actors might suggest is the best policy.
Okay, Ron, I heard Professor Hill, and I thought Dr. Hill was kind of interesting because Dr. Hill talked about two tracks. One was foreign policy, and one was Donald Trump's domestic agenda. And they're not the same. And that she was following the foreign policy as laid out by Congress, not just a bunch of bureaucrats that have been around for decades, but technically this is our policy. And what she found out was that there was a divergence between what our foreign policy was and what would serve President Trump's domestic
political goals.
Agenda.
Right.
Ron?
I'm not sure what the question is but...
More about how we present what happened the last 2 weeks so that the American people can hear it. I mean, Donald Trump is very effective at messaging. So what's the message for Donald Trump? Read the transcript. It was perfect. Read the transcript. What's the other side's message?
Read the transcript.
Yeah.
Or get it first. It's in a safe box.
Because I think we're not really disagreeing that much about the facts for a change. I mean, there are characterizations and spin like there would always be. I've viewed the impeachment hearings through my lens as having been a practicing lawyer, having done criminal defense work for the last 26 plus years. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't watch or listen to that much because I wanted to scream objection every 30 seconds because it's not an actual trial and the rules of evidence don't apply. And, you know, nobody seems to have a clue what the heck hearsay actually is when they're having this discussion. You know, going back to Dean's point, I think there's a new option for how a president is sort of reworking policy at every level and in every realm, and that is not going around, not going through, but just blowing it all up.
Right.
We're seeing that with this whole issue of the military pardons and then the pushback from the powers that be and the firing and the threats of resignation. I mean, at some point – I think we need to reclaim deep state as an actual positive term in the sense that the deep state is an entrenched series of professionals who provide us with continuity, provide us with reason, and try as best they can to function, you know, apolitically, or at least nonpartisan, in a nonpartisan way.
I agree with that generally, although there is a long tradition in political science of literature about bureaucratic capture and the ways in which bureaucracy kind of grows in a piecemeal fashion to protect turf and to serve clients and all that
stuff.
I think generally your point is well taken, but there is this, just to balance it out, there is this other whole world of kind of bureaucracy working
in
ways
that
is not.
And
as an immigration lawyer, I wouldn't understand anything about that.
Absolutely.
Well, Stephen, I posted on Facebook as I was trying to figure out what is the messaging and how do you I think you say you don't want your students to curl into a ball and think, oh my God, what do? I'm going to give up. There's no point in this. And I'm looking at the results of the Hong Kong election, and they are stunning. They are stunning. It was an overwhelming support in the largest turnout ever, I believe, in Hong Kong's history for pro-democracy movement, okay? Mm-hmm. And I wrote the following, because this goes directly to what you just said as you opened, Stephen, and that is, can we find the same courage in 2020 and vote for real democratic values and real change? I mean, these people are putting their lives on the line by exercising the franchise. They know that what China wants to do, they know what China is capable of doing. They've already seen weeks and weeks and weeks of violence. And yet, look what they did. And in a bizarre way, it almost brought about a calm in the fact that they not only showed up in numbers, and numbers have power, but they sent a powerful message to China about, you know, this is not necessarily going to work the way you want it, and violence isn't going to produce a result. I'm not sure that it's going to be beneficial not only to Hong Kong but to China. But I think what happened in Hong Kong is a powerful testament to what you just said, which is to find courage.
And I think that election is a part of the story, but I think it's only part of the story. And I think that you know, I've got a long-standing critique that we pay way too much attention to electoral politics and not to such things as movement politics. And I think you cannot make sense of the Hong Kong story without also talking about the circumstances that lead to mass mobilizations. And when I look at sort of the much larger picture of the state of the American political system, only some of that can be resolved through the electoral system itself, and absent, and this is my read of history as well, absent large-scale mobilizations of exceedingly large numbers of people sustained over time, pushing against the system and forcing it to do things it does not want to do, then the change that comes from elections only can get you so far.
So what is the movement, Ron Abramson, in the sense that so I'm hearing that one of the reasons why Biden does so well with black voters, we're seeing it in places like South Carolina, is that they are a little more afraid of movements, even though they're the inspiration behind the civil rights movement and everything else. But right now, they are more afraid of what radical change will look like. And in a lot of ways, that's one of the reasons why Biden is a comfortable connection for them. Obama didn't produce radical change. In fact, he probably disappointed a number of people within the black community. But yet they fear radical change. And maybe there's a reason for that, because maybe not only will they be blamed for it, but they will suffer the consequences of it.
Can I just say that the Democrats did not bring us the civil rights gains? It was the civil rights movement, the mobilization that Stephen was talking about that made John F. Kennedy actually agree to.
I understand, but it was a movement that he was talking about. It was a movement driven by the black community, not by Democrats. I'm not suggesting that. But what I'm thinking is that I'm hearing this now, that that's one of the excuses for why they kind of like Biden, is that they like Biden's sort of modest, slow gestures. Mm-hmm.
I have not heard that. I have been somewhat mystified, other than, you know, having President Obama's glow or shadow working in his favor, and there is a long-term familiarity among voters with Joe Biden, which at this point seems to cut both ways, depending on who you are and what your priorities are. That was an absolutely perfect segue into this discussion by Stephen, so thank you. It seems that, I mean, the Democratic primary, there is no clearly applicable history because we haven't had this many people ever run for the nomination who are credible candidates. But we're seeing these fissures forming, and you know, somebody like Elizabeth Warren is getting critiques from all sides. She's not progressive enough for some people.
I know. I read the Guardian article.
Right. She's too progressive for others. Yeah. And you know, other people find her not to be trustworthy, which just is mind-boggling to me. She has tended to keep her word virtually every time she's given it. But you know, the fact that somebody like Mayor Bloomberg has jumped into the race, I mean, there are people who are theorizing that he's not doing it out of a sincere desire to be president. He's doing it to have the ability to throw all this money through a legitimate way to oppose the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren candidacies.
You know, it's really interesting you say that. I'm going to toss to Dean on this one, Ron. I heard on MSNBC, I almost wrote a scathing op-ed. And Stephanie Ruhle, who used to work for Bloomberg, I guess also authored a piece because she did an interview with him. And I call this media malpractice or, frankly, you're in bed with the mayor. And what she was asked was, she was asked on MSNBC, did you ask him whether the fact that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are running on things like a wealth tax, did that inspire you to run? She goes, I didn't ask that question. Of all the questions, Dean, for her not to ask, that would have been my first question, my middle question, and my last question. And she did not ask that question. How do you get Bloomberg into your I think there is a movement going on. But can I tell you, Stephen, what kind of movement? And I'm going to turn to Dean. But, Stephen, the movement I see is the movement among billionaires. I think there's a billionaire movement going on.
I was waiting to see how Arnie was going to set me defend Biden and Bloomberg,
No, 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 no. But that's what I see. I see a movement happening, but it's a movement with, you know, the head of Amazon and a number of other billionaires.
The poorer billionaires, the Tom Steyers who are just, you know, lowly one point something billionaires, they don't fall into that camp.
No. But there is an interesting movement with the 20 plus billion.
The plutocrats.
Anyway, look at this. Go on.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that, you know, let's put Biden aside for a moment because I don't know that he will be the standard bearer for the kind of non-progressive wing of the party and maybe somebody else. But, you know, Bloomberg has been quite clear that he's getting to the race precisely because he believes that Sanders and Warren are too progressive, and then that's a losing recipe for the fall general election. And, you know, this fissure that Ron is talking about, been there for a long time. It's coming out into the open.
Goes all the way back to the
Democratic Leadership Council and Joe Lieberman and Evan Bayh and Bill and Hillary Clinton. And just the power, the sort of center of power has shifted a bit over the last, you know, almost 25 years at this point, plus 25 plus. So there's just a debate about how you go about winning in the general election. Some folks believe that it has to be a base mobilization election in which you get progressives excited about policy. Others say that that's going to lose independents, it's going to lose moderate Democrats. They're either going to stay home or they're going to vote for, you know, hold their nose and vote for Trump. And so that's the debate. I don't know how it's going to be resolved. Now, Bloomberg certainly could have, instead of getting into the race, put his money into other candidacies, got other people.
No,
he could have done that if he wanted to. You know, my sense is he thinks he can. You know, he's a pretty confident guy.
I'm not sure it's about winning. Anyway, we need to shut down this part of Rethink the Week. Ron Abramson, Dean Spiliotis, and Stephen Pimper. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arnison, producer Ken Barnes. A little labor history is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1947. That was the day that the front page of the Chicago Tribune printed a banner headline, "Newspaper Printers Quit." 1,600 members of the International Typographical Union Local 16 had gone out on strike against six Chicago newspapers. The key reason for the strike was wages. The union also wanted the publishers to agree to hire only union labor. The walkout was part of a wave of printer strikes in the United States and Canada. In all, union members from 43 newspapers from 27 cities went out on strike. Most newspapers were able to keep printing during the walkouts, but many had to reduce the number of editions or make changes in how the paper was produced. According to an article published by the Associated Press, some are using a photo engraving process to circumvent their composing rooms, while others continue to use the normal methods. The Chicago strike wore on for 22 months. The strike also became an important labor struggle after the passage of the Taft-Hartley legislation. The legislation, approved by Congress earlier that year over President Harry Truman's veto, restricted the rights of labor unions, including outlawing the closed shop. Since the typographical unions were some of the oldest trade unions in the country, the strike became an important battleground over how Taft-Hartley would be interpreted. The American Newspaper Publishers Association hoped that Taft-Hartley could be a tool in smashing the strike. The courts sided with the publishers and demanded the union drop their demand for a closed shop. In the end, the union did win a $10 raise, a little more than two-thirds the amount they asked for during the strike. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
There are few actions as consequential as the impeachment of the president. I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. And that's what Representative Adam Schiff, chair of the House Intelligence Committee, said in his opening statement on the first day of the impeachment hearings. President Trump's supporters, in contrast, have characterized the impeachment process as an attempt to overrule or negate the results of the 2016 election. Let's look at the Constitution. Impeachment and the possibility of removal of a duly elected president from office was very much on the minds of the founders. We know this because the Constitution is chock full of references to impeachment, with provisions regarding where the trial is, the Senate, and who decides, the senators, not a jury, and what the vote must be, a two-thirds majority, and who presides, the Chief Justice, and what the penalty must be, removal from office, and what additional punishment is possible, a bar to further holding of office, and the grounds, treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors, and the effect on other criminal prosecutions after the president leaves office, none, and who takes over after the removal, the vice president. So, yes, this is indeed a very consequential action. But no, the founders did not view the process as overruling an election. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom can't protect itself.
Everyone, we are back. This is The Attitude with Artie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It is our Rethink the Week with Ron Abramson, immigration lawyer, with Stephen Pimper, Casey Fellow at UNH, and Dean Spiliotis, a civic and presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. The song that you picked, I Am Woman by Helen Reddy, did not come up, so I apologize, Ken. But I picked Aretha Franklin's Think for two reasons. Because, one, she's a powerful woman, which is how we began our show. She talked a little bit about movement with freedom. So it really, in a lot of ways, her music, and I think this is an opportunity where I actually said, how do we get the American people to think when it comes to what they were able to see last week during the impeachment trials?
Yeah, and the reason I chose Woman's Song, and this is this is a good one too, is because you were talking at the beginning about the amazing, powerful women in
Dr. Hill, State Department.
As well as men, but there are a lot of accomplished women who are standing up for our country and doing the right thing. And then the other reason is Elizabeth Warren. There are two things that people are worried she might not be electable. One is
she's
because
female.
She may be too progressive, and the other is country's not ready for a woman. Unbelievable as that might be.
All right. Oh, God, it gives me an ulcer. Anyway, so I'm gonna start with Dean. So, Dean, I think the reason why there's a group of people that are ecstatic that Mayor Bloomberg is probably going to spend hundreds of millions, if not even a billion, because he could easily do that without even noticing, on this campaign. And that is that what he is doing with his messaging, whether it ultimately gets him elected or not, is that he's messaging the more moderate, pro-corporate message. And as a result, even if he doesn't benefit, the DNC is a happy camper. Barack Obama is a happy camper. Mayor Pete is a happy camper. Joe Biden is a happy camper. To some extent, even Corey is a happy camper. Because in a lot of ways, he becomes the echo chamber for them. And even if he doesn't get the result, his messaging is really, to a large extent, mirroring a message of a much more sort of, you know, moderate message. And that then only gets reinforced by the candidates who are on the debate stage, the candidates who are running in South Carolina, New Hampshire, Nevada, whatever. And I think in a lot of ways for the DNC and for Barack Obama, it's a win-win.
Well, he has the resources to do that.
Totally.
It was $31 million ad buy, I think, for 1 week.
Yeah, for 1 week.
And I mean, I've already seen him on television repeatedly just in the last 24 hours every time I look up. So, yeah, I mean, like I said before, he's been very open that was his intention. It was to get in on that side of the debate, he can do it with a lot of money. He can give that, as you said, an echo chamber. He can give that side of the argument a lot more visibility than it had had for a while. I mean, it's kind of been a two-stage process. For a long time, the primary was all about progressive politics, and Joe Biden was this sort of in decline, moderate wing of the party. And then others saw an opportunity, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Cory Booker, and others, to kind of fill that, to, you know, sort of compete with Biden more directly. And now that was the first step. And now you've got Bloomberg coming in with all that cash to further magnify the argument. I'm fascinated to see how it plays out over the first 2 months of actual voting, February and March, and then maybe we'll get a better sense. Everybody I talk to on both sides of this divide feels very passionately that the other side's got the wrong strategy. The moderates think progressives have the wrong strategy. Progressives think moderates have the wrong strategy. And that's just within the party. We haven't even talked about the general.
Hold on, Stephen. Let me just grab Ron, and then I'll grab you. Ron's hands up.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but Bloomberg did not file in New Hampshire, correct?
No.
It was all
he's skipping the first four.
So
he's going straight to Super Tuesday.
How credible a candidacy is that?
Stephen, you respond.
So I think we should be cautious about taking Bloomberg at his word when he describes himself as a moderate. And I think we should be more careful about allowing that to become the narrative. I lived through the Bloomberg years in New York, as I did the Giuliani years. It's all like some horrible nightmare coming back to me.
Yeah.
But Bloomberg is an autocrat. Bloomberg is someone who has demonstrated himself utterly contemptuous of democratic processes and looked for every available opportunity to use executive power as mayor to circumvent the New York City Council, to circumvent borough representatives, to circumvent the popular will by having fought to repeal the law that forbade him from a third term. He, in my experience, and there's lots of good reporting to back this up, is enormously impressed with himself and his abilities. And I can't read his mind, and I do not know whether he genuinely wants to be president or not, but there is no doubt in my mind that he believes that he is uniquely suited to the job.
Yeah, and I just to jump in, that's a fair point, but I was when I talk about him being moderate, I'm talking solely in terms of policy positions, you know, opposing Medicare for all, opposing the Green New Deal, free university tuition. Absolutely. You can talk about leadership style being either autocratic or, consensus building. And, yeah, he's had a long history of calling the shots.
So and I was talking to a group of Democrats over the weekend, actually from California, and we were trying to decide, is it better to have a despot or a benevolent despot? Because I see Bloomberg as
only choices?
No. Stevens, calm down. But I was talking to a guy who's written a lot about Bloomberg. Like you, he still lives in New York. And so he's covered Bloomberg for a long time. And one of the things he did say was that he has the most amazing Rolodex in America. And in part, the value of being Ron, the value of him being a three-term governor of the city of New York, mayor of New York, is that he has a Rolodex of mayors.
That's the problem. We're in a post-Rolodex society. We don't need a Rolodex person.
No, but you're wrong. It's a Rolodex. Stephen, Am I right? He has a Rolodex of mayors because he organized the mayors on guns. He's organized the mayors on climate. He's organized them. So he has a network that you are now seeing beginning to show up in his support, Stephen. So I understand how he operated in New York, but from mayors who desperately needed someone to support them and help them with their own messaging, I have to tell you, he was pretty effective in articulating a gun message at a time that the Democrats and a lot of people were disgusted with the cowardice of I think, my side of the aisle. Stephen?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would echo the question about whether sort of the Rolodex in that regard is necessary or useful necessarily. I mean, I will say sort of to offer the other side of my and others' experience of him as mayor. He was extraordinarily competent. I mean, he is, in terms of just sort of effective, the ability to get complicated institutions to turn to his will, just as sort of a public administration guy, I was exceedingly impressed. Now, one of the things that we can anticipate is any Democrat, should there be a Democrat coming into office in 2021, among their challenges is going to rebuild a fairly profoundly hollowed out federal bureaucracy. It may be that Bloomberg brings to that particular task a unique set of applicable skills.
Dean, but we also know this is a turnout election, that it's going to be so much about turnout. We know that Donald Trump has, you know, basically the control of 38 to 40% of the population. I mean, they're his. There's nothing he can do that can change. I said that, you know, for evangelicals, Donald Trump is their sinner. For the GOP, especially the GOP that we're seeing, the elected GOP, you know, he is their traitor. You know, and they will accept everything he does, even if it's destructive to democracy, even if it's destructive to our foreign policy. And the reason why the evangelicals like him is that he's delivered on eroding Roe. He's delivered on packing the courts. He's delivered on basically, you know, marginalizing the homosexual community and doing whatever he can in a subtle way to undermine their ability to operate.
He's delivered on getting the rest of us to pray.
Exactly right. That's right.
Just not for what they want us to pray
exactly.
For.
But Dean, he is their traitor. I mean, when you listen to Lindsey Graham now suggesting that maybe we need to look into Ukraine because maybe they were the ones that were involved in the 2016 election, and every single operation that has looked at this has said it's the exact opposite. These are the Russian talking points. He clearly is their traitor. And from at least Lindsey Graham's perspective, he has delivered because Lindsey Graham is terrified of challenging Trump because of the Republican base in South Carolina. So as I'm looking at this, I'm just trying to figure out, how does a Bloomberg or even a Biden excite a base where you not only want your base to come out, you want to expand your base? What's the invitation of Bloomberg to an expanded base?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the question. And this gets back to the debate over, you know, it's a turnout election. What does that mean? Maximum number of base supporters turning out or getting increased numbers of people, independents, to engage the process? And that's the debate. Now, you know, on a personal level, I think Bloomberg, you know, given his long experience with Trump, given his own business success, there's sort of aspect of him going toe-to-toe to Trump, which is actually quite – I think he feels quite comfortable. And he seems at some level
– they're both arrogant.
He seems at some level to be able to get under Trump's skin in a way that others might not, which is interesting. That doesn't help you with exciting progressives on a policy component. And I think there's also some – you know, Biden also is comfortable with swinging back at him. But that's a separate issue than whether you're exciting
people. But he seems to have a slow swing.
Well, maybe he's taking a little bit off the fastball now. But, yeah, I don't have an easy answer for that. I don't know that it's – I mean, I'm not coming into this saying that it's going to work for Bloomberg. I have a lot of questions about his ability to get traction. He thinks he can, but that remains to be seen.
So Stephen, you mentioned that you lived in New York with Giuliani and with Bloomberg. So here's the question.
That must have been some apartment.
Trump, too. It was very crowded.
So here's my question for Mayor Bloomberg. Since he was managed to turn around the term limits and get a third term, in part because he spent $105 per vote, it turned out that two-thirds of the city council at the time he wanted to go to a third term would have benefited from a third term because they were term limited
exactly
as well.
Right. Smart politics.
Oh, it's brilliant politics.
Clever.
Oh, very clever. But he's not that clever. Because the reason he's not that clever is that everybody knew that Trump was a crook. Everybody knew that he abused the rules. Everybody knew that he didn't pay his bills. Everybody knew that he manipulated the system in New York. How come Mayor Bloomberg didn't throw the book at Donald Trump when he was mayor for three terms?
I mean, I think in retrospect, knowing what would become of Trump, he or anybody else would have. I mean, I just think that
they had lots of opportunity. He was mayor.
Your list of people who in your federal and state agencies are prosecuting corrupt activity is so long that I'm not sure. That doesn't strike me as unusual at all, that Trump would necessarily come to the top of that list.
Well, you know, but here's the irony of all this. He doesn't come to the top of the list. Who did come to the top of the list when Mayor Bloomberg was mayor? No, I want to know.
Black people on the street. Well,
exactly. Yeah, I want to know the
exactly
corruption.
Right.
Exactly right.
Vulnerable populations.
Thank you.
In communities.
Bingo. That's my point. Where did you see corruption, Mayor Bloomberg? You saw corruption with your stop and frisk. Tell me about the corporate corruption, the real estate corruption, the deep donor corruption. I want to know about that. I would love to see him list that corruption. It's just like the corruption I want Donald Trump to talk about. The only corruption Donald Trump knows about is corruption in Ukraine that involves Hunter and Joe Biden. He doesn't know any other corruption.
Surprisingly enough, Mayor Giuliani, when he was mayor, he rose to fame by going and making corporate brokers do perp walks.
Yeah, exactly.
He went after the white collar.
Well, if you read Matt Taibbi's book, The Divide, it lays it all out about how basically we have aggressively policed any whiff of welfare fraud, but we've let all the financial malfeasance at the macro level go unprosecuted with the exception of one bank, small bank in New York.
Right.
And dare I say, that is exactly what Elizabeth Warren's message is. That's the base of her corruption speech.
Oh, God. All right. So we haven't talked about it, although we've sort of touched on it slightly. Pentagon chief fires Navy secretary over SEAL case. This is actually, I think, one of the more shocking stories of his entire time as President of the United States, Steven Pimper. This is scary. This is scary on so many levels because it's a level of micromanagement that is shocking. It undermines anything in the way of military justice and how they sort of set a standard for behavior. I mean, we already know that Donald Trump loves the idea of waterboarding. He loves the idea of doing actually horrific things to people. He keeps even on occasion threatening to drop the atomic bomb. So this story isn't just about the firing. It's how is the military going to respond to this, because it undermines their ability to even establish what is order. And when you can't establish what is order, I don't know where you go, Steven Pimper.
You know, it is troubling, but also I think in some ways it's entirely and perfectly consistent with what we've seen, right? At least in two ways. One is that this has been a cause celebre on Fox for some extended period of time now, and there is this growing corpus of evidence demonstrating the disconcerting influence that Fox News has, which we should think of as a propaganda channel rather than a news network, if we are being perfectly frank, over the president himself. That's thing one, right, is sort of an evidence of the continued influence of that particular avenue of the fever swamp. The other is, of course, the utter and complete contempt for the notion of the rule of law, something the admiral himself pointed out in his resignation or accepting his firing letter, depending on whether we figure out what's going on there or not. That is, I think, the larger worry for me. I think that the military is boxed into its own complicated kind of corner, given the manner in which it historically operates. Dean talked earlier about the ongoing historical battles between the president and the rest of the executive branch and how common that is, though it takes a different form in different administrations. The same may be said of the military, but I think that that's historically been less prominent. So I wonder if we will start to see that kind of politicization in the military emerge as a consequence of Trump's inserting himself into it.
All right. So Dean is at the leave. So I just want to – I normally would have turned to him, but I'm going to turn to you, Ron, because Donald Trump is at war with everything. He's at war with the military. He's at war with the bureaucracy. He's at war with Congress. He's at war with voters. He's at war with the media. He's FBI. At war with everyone. I mean, he's just at war with everyone. And therefore, I'm just trying to figure out what is the way forward, because there's a group, his base, who clearly supports that idea of being at war with everything, because the Republican Party for the longest time said government is the problem. Basically, they could see no solution that government can offer, that government was really the alpha and omega of failure. And so in a lot of ways, what Donald Trump is doing by being at war with all of them is that he is actually celebrating that ideology, taking it to a place maybe Republicans never thought possible. But in a lot of ways, they've been fed this line for decades, and Donald Trump is delivering on that ideology if you play it out.
Wow, there's a lot to unpack there.
I know.
The first thing I would say is the president tends to be at war while simultaneously pandering to some of the same interests. I mean, he's at war with the military, but really only with the elements of the military or anything else which don't agree with him wholeheartedly. And I think what you're identifying is this libertarian streak in a significant part of the Republican Party, historically an ideology, which just says less government, less government. The problem is that in the vacuum we have now, it's been replaced with what feels like an anarchical approach. You know, we're talking about chaos and anarchy. I mean, we're not talking about any cohesive governing, even smaller governing ideology or philosophy or implementation of policies that will, at the end of the day, make more things better for more people. You know, that tends to be my guiding principle when it comes to public policy. What will make things better for more people? And even if it means, and it often does, it has to be to some extent at the expense of others. And this is why when you have 600 billionaires in the United States who have all this massive fortune of which they can dedicate what are huge dollars but small percentages to stopping, to anti-messaging on a certain issue or a certain candidacy, it's a problem. And we have just this grotesque imbalance of voice in this democracy right now.
But you know what's so interesting here, Stephen, and I'm pretty sure I'm right. I haven't been following the story as intimately as I should.
You're usually pretty sure.
All right. But my understanding is that this Navy SEAL, that the judicial arm of the Navy was actually five fellow SEAL members, that he was being judged by his fellow SEAL members. That story has not come out.
Oh, he was reported by his own men.
Right. No, he was not.
Who launched the initial complaint, right?
There is
no defense of this guy in any rational world.
And I want people to understand that this was judgment by his peers.
Yep.
These were other SEALs making a decision on a fellow SEAL. This was not a military officer from above. This was not orders from someone. This was his – that to me is the most powerful part of the story. And again, what I think is so unfortunate is that Donald Trump has a messaging machine, Fox. Okay? So they promote the lies. They support the idea of supporting the SEAL. The other side, including, frankly, the military, hasn't figured out a way to do the messaging to let people know that it was his fellow SEALs that did this. That, to me, would be a shock in places like Kentucky. It would be a shock in places like Alabama that who made the decision wasn't on high. It was the guy standing next to him. And that's the foxhole. That's the guy that you've got to trust. And what you are doing is not only affecting military, it's affecting the idea of trusting the guy standing next to you. And, Stephen, that is so important because I don't care whether you serve or don't serve. That's what you want is someone to have your back.
You know, and I mean, I think that points to for me, one of the larger conundrums of this particular moment in American political history is that given the radical but asymmetric polarization, the construction of what some of my people call epistemic closure, right? These sort of closed information loops that make it possible for people not to encounter contradictory information. And what we know from political psychology, which tells us that often partisans who encounter contradictory information that challenges their worldview actually are more likely to root deeper in their worldview rather than change their mind. I think that your question sort of raises the point, is there a breaking point? Is there a moment, right? Is it the military? Is it another institution? Is there any place in the American political system where those folks will surrender that ideological partisan attachment? And so far, the answer seems to be no, and that is troubling.
So Before we leave the show, Rethink the Week, Ron, one of the things I keep thinking about, and I go back to what happened with the SEAL, and then I go back to the Republicans and Lindsey Graham on Ukraine. And that is that my understanding is that they're asking for all kinds of documents in order to show what happened with Ukraine and the Bidens, okay? What happened during the Obama administration. So how does Barr produce documents for this but not documents for Adam Schiff? How do you do that?
There's a legal term. I don't want to confuse things too much. It's called chutzpah.
I am listening to the request for documentation, and I am going, I dare you. I dare you.
There's no ideological consistency, and that's one of the frustrations is that there are two different sets of standards and expectations. I mean, when you look at any of the critique that any of the Democratic candidates is receiving right now, and you juxtapose that with the fact that the president has gotten a pass on virtually everything he has done or tried to do, I mean, the double standard is not even
a
double standard because one side there is no standard.
There is
exactly.
No standard. There is no
exactly.
Standard.
And I don't know what it's going to take. And the courts have done a decent job of checking some of this. But, you know, let's look at the tax record. That every court has unanimously said that they have to turn over the president's tax records for the New York State investigation. The Supreme Court expectedly put a stay on that. While they're ruling, because there was no way to put the genie back in the bottle if there was no stay. But there's really no way to know what they're going to do at this point. And it seems legally very clear. But if the focus of all of this is to protect executive authority and violate, the court's going to go through all kinds of gymnastics to preserve that.
Rethink the Week is over. Stephen Pimper, Dean Spiliotis is not here, Ron Abramson. First of all, happy Thanksgiving to everyone and to you guys. And again, thank you so much. After this show, I always want to go into therapy. All right. So how do we end this?
This is my therapy.
This is your therapy.
We got a week for therapy.
Okay. All right.
We end with Taking It to the Streets by the Doobie Brothers. And Taking It to the Streets is what the people in Hong Kong did to make democracy, to have an election. It's what the American people are doing a lot more of and need to do even more.
Remember Hong Kong in 2020. All right, everyone. Yes. Talk to you tomorrow. Ciao.